www.ReachForTheStars.org.
Okay, good afternoon. Welcome to the Third Opinion. Two Jews, three opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
Good morning, Lorene Jaffe, or afternoon.
Afternoon. It's
afternoon.
It's crossed over the threshold to afternoon. Glad you're with us today. If you've never listened to our show before, we talk about Jewish issues that are important not only in our area, but throughout the United States and nationwide. We will take calls this afternoon. If you want to call in later on, we'll give you the numbers and give you a chance. If you want to tell us how wonderful you think we are, or tell us why you think we're wrong, as so many of the callers try to do.
Yes, that's right. So we are wrapping up
Simchat Torah, your favorite holiday.
Right. So, well, Sukkot leading to Simchat Torah. So Sukkot, you know, where we eat in the sukkah, we rejoice for 7 days. So now we're going into Simchat Torah. So quick little Jewish lesson for the day for our non-Jewish listeners. It's actually a great celebration. We rewind, in essence, like you roll back the Torah scroll. So every year we read through the entire Torah, and then on Simchat Torah, it is a celebration. I call it rewind.
You take the scrolls and
twist them. But it's a day of celebration and dancing. And so you will see us dancing with the Torah. Very common to be dancing. It's a great celebration. And we rejoice and celebrate the Torah, the word that Hashem gave to us in Mount Horeb. So it's a big deal. So it is actually quite a bit of fun. Lots of celebration. So, you know, it's wrapping up our fall feast times. We have a lot of feasts and festivities.
We do. You know, speaking of the Torah, I learned something during the high holiday services. I was always told, or I was taught, that if you drop a Torah, you have to fast for 40 days, rabbis in particular.
Right.
Well, first off, that is not a law. It's a tradition. The fast is not like a Yom Kippur fast. It's more like a Ramadan fast from sunup to sundown.
Right, half-day fast.
Half-day fast. But also, the rabbi in charge of whatever congregation it is can forgive the fast. It's not a hard and fast rule.
Right. So he can absolve you. You can absolve.
Yeah. I had always been taught, you know, as I was going to Hebrew school and all, do not drop the Torah, or you're going to have to fast for 40 days. It was like, so you clutched it with your life.
Which, by the way, I just use the word absolve, and the word absolve, that actually just reminded me. There's a great movie. It's an Israeli movie called Ushpizin. Ushpizin is the Hebrew word for guests, which is, you know, great mitzvot if you have guests over Sukkot. So this is it was funny. So for Sukkot every year, I like to rewatch the film. It's actually very funny. But it's lovely. It's like this religious couple, but it's a quirky film, but it's a great film for anyone who likes.
Boy, that surprises me, you watching a quirky film.
This weekend I watched another one. Not quirky, but really educational. It was called The Hope, and it's really about the founding of the State of Israel. It goes back to the history of Herzl. Of Chaim, and you go into the Ben Gurion, but the idea of writing the book that he wrote, The Jewish State, and this idea that you know, it didn't matter where we lived, and no matter how hard Jews tried to assimilate, that there was always this anti-Semitism. I learned so much about Herzl this weekend that I never even realized.
Oh, you told me some fascinating stuff.
Right, the father of Zionism. So 3 years before he wrote The Jewish State, I mean, this is the same guy who had fully assimilated. His parents had, you know, were assimilated into society, and they, you know, and had, instead of having a bar mitzvah, had a confirmation, and had recommended in something he wrote that all Jews go and have like this mass baptism at the church as a way to assimilate and be, you know, perceived as like everyone else. Obviously, he rejected that idea after 3 years later, after the Dreyfus Affair, and wrote The Jewish State. But so educational. And it's that constant pull, because even when he wrote The Jewish State, it was like the same thing we see today. You know, you had the very sort of liberal elite Jews who had fully assimilated into society, who are like, no, we don't need our own state. You know, we want to be like everyone else. And then you had the very ultra religious rabbis who were like, no, we cannot have Israel until the Mashiach returns. You know, we got to have the Mashiach come. And so you've got this whole concept of this constant pull between these two ideas that I think still exists in many ways today.
But as we were talking, that the reform movement in the 50s, particularly here, was not a big supporter of Israel. They were more of the assimilate. And, you know, I guess I think part of it came from a World War II fear because of the Holocaust. And they said, okay, let's just fit in. Be low key, be quiet.
Right.
Which does not fit with our beliefs, obviously.
The idea, and wait, so later today, by the way, we're going to have a great, one of the greatest historians of American Jews, Professor Dr. Sarna, will be with us, and we're going to interview and talk with him about some very interesting topics related to Jews in this country, as well as how Jews have been treated in this country. So, very excited about that. But news for Jews.
News for Jews. There is a ton of it. The Tree of Life Synagogue is going to reopen as a center for Jewish life in the United States. That was the site of the attack a year ago, where 11 people were killed, and it was deemed afterwards it's just not a good place for religious worship because of the decimation that went on and the desecration of the synagogue there. So it's going to reopen as a center for Jewish life in the United States. And I'm glad to see at least they are trying to make something positive out of something that was so, so negative.
Right. And, you know, because we're coming up on that 1 year anniversary, and I did see it. So they're going to be utilizing it for several things. I thought they were going to use it for some worship. I don't know. But I do know they're going to have obviously some teachings there on the Holocaust, as well as just Jewish life in general. But just a great, I think that's just, you know, it is called the Tree of Life. Let's restore life to that place. Let's make something beautiful out of something that was very ugly. And of course, as that prosecution of that shooter, that murderer still continues.
You're right. I'm looking down here. It says the plans reportedly include a worship space for the congregation who wants to return there.
Oh,
so they will have a little spot within the center for a worship space, but the whole thing won't reopen as a synagogue, my understanding. But
right.
But yeah, you talk about the 1 year anniversary coming up.
Interesting. So yeah, so really nice. So some sad news, and this goes back to, we were obviously having a debate last week with some of our callers on whether Jeremy Corbyn was anti-Semitic.
Absolutely, right.
So here, let's chat about that. So we just had this UK, a Jewish MP, a member of 55 years of being a member of the Labour Party. She, in essence, had to resign. She stepped down from the party. She said she couldn't do it anymore because of the leader, Jeremy Corbyn, and his anti-Semitism, that she is deeply, deeply troubled. And so this is Dame Louise Ellman. So she has left the party. I think that was just very interesting.
You know, there is a lot of anti-Semitism in Europe and in England. Well, I just saw something, but I've got something here about swastikas being... here it is. Anti-Semitic hate crimes nearly doubled in England in 2018.
Wow.
So when you have a leader of one of the parties blatantly using anti-Semitic terms, it is not surprising that people think, well, it's okay if he can... talk badly about Jewish people, why can we not talk badly about Jewish people? As I said last week, England is in a mess. You got Boris Johnson, who is just crazy as far as I am concerned, and then Jeremy Corbyn. Yeah, I got to hold back my opinions, right? Then Jeremy Corbyn, who is anti-Semitic, and one of the two of them is going to be leading.
Right, and you know, I think it's, I mean, right now Boris Johnson is leading, but we've got, you know, but Jeremy Corbyn is the largest opposition party, and he leads the labor movement. This MP, she's not the first to leave the Labor Party, who is a lifelong labor member, has served for, you know, most of her adult life. She's not the first to leave because of this, because she feels like the Labor Party is not properly responding to this open anti-Semitic rhetoric. And I thought, you know, and here she was challenged by members of her own party. They were going to put her up for a no confidence vote on the eve of Yom Kippur. I mean, that to me is just such a disgrace. And that tells you, I mean, that was intentional thinking on their part. And this goes to the point that it is. It's there. You can't ignore it. You've got to address it when you see it. And so anyway, we can't be silent. So we did lose a great this week. I'm so sad. And really, I opened up my phone and I saw the news.
I saw it about 5 o'clock in the morning.
I was stunned.
The day that Elijah Cummings died. And I went, oh man, I hope this is a fake news type thing. And then I saw more and more coming in.
What a great man. I mean, he's such a great man. So just really sad. He's been a champion for civil rights. He was a champion also for the Jewish community. And just, it's a great loss to our community as well to lose him. So just really sad to see that and just surprised by it. I had no idea that he was even ill. So
And you know, he got his first job at a pharmacy owned by a Jewish person. And he was a real friend of the Jewish community. In fact, he was a great person. He tried to bring the Jewish and African American community back together because he was at the forefront of the civil rights movement.
Right.
And he realized that Jewish people were very supportive of the civil rights movement. And there has been, for some reason, including a Farrakhan type push by some people in the African American community to separate us. And we have so much in common.
Right.
We have so much. And so
I think we're better together, right?
Absolutely.
We're better working together and fighting together and standing with each other to protect civil rights and human rights for all. So definitely.
We have our guest on the phone with us right now. So why don't you introduce him?
Yes. So, okay. Well, that is very exciting. So as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, we have a special guest with us today, Dr. Jonathan Sarna. He is a professor at Brandeis University. He's considered pretty much one of the preeminent historian on the American Jewish history. And so we consider it a great honor to have him with us today. He's written just some really fascinating books, Lincoln and the Jews, when General Grant expelled the Jews, for instance. His highly acclaimed book on our history called American Judaism, A History, but writes frequently for Forward Magazine. And some of you may be familiar with him, but just such a pleasure to have him with us today to talk about Jews in America and, you know, some of the issues that we're talking about right now.
Dr. Sarna, welcome to Third Opinion.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Absolutely. So we obviously greatly honored to have you join us today. And one of the topics that we often touch on our show is anti-Semitism. And I know I've read articles of yours or commentaries on anti-Semitism in America and sort of the Jewish experience. You know, sort of with your understanding and appreciation as you reflect on it today, do you see a difference in anti-Semitism in the country today as you would have maybe even 100 years ago or 50 years ago? And will we get past this?
Well, anti-Semitism in America has been somewhat cyclical. The last time we talked a lot about anti-Semitism was probably in the early 1990s at the time of the Crown Heights riot, and that was linked with issues between African Americans and Jews.
Which we were just talking about, how there has been that separation.
Yeah, and you were talking about Congressman Cummings, who really tried to bring those communities together. There were other, often younger at that time, African Americans who really sought to make a place for themselves in the African American community by making a wedge between the older leaders and the Jews. So the older leaders were seen as pro-Jewish. The younger ones said, will be anti-Jewish.
What caused that schism?
Well, as I say, I think it had a lot to do with internal politics in the African-American community at that time, a sense that younger, more impatient leaders felt that the older leaders, the Martin Luther Kings, the Cummings, the A. Philip Randolphs, that they had worked closely with Jews, and this younger group, some of them influenced by radical Islam, and others simply trying to differentiate themselves from older leaders, they sought to use anti-Semitism. But of course, after the early 1990s, in most communities, what we find are blacks and Jews don't live very close to one another. And more importantly, there developed an idea in America that prejudice only exists against people of color, that Jews in America had become white folks. There was a famous book, How Jews Became White Folks, by Karen Brodkin. And that, you know, anti-Semitism was history only studied by people like me. It was all in the past. And that's why I think a young generation of Jews, my students, Jews who don't really remember the 90s or earlier bouts of anti-Semitism, were so shocked, first by Charlottesville, the Jews will not replace us, which they didn't even understand. And then, of course, by Tree of Life, by Poway, and by a growing realization that there was anti-Semitism found both on the extreme right and on the extreme left. That's what's unusual about anti-Semitism, is that it's found on both extremes. That's long been true. Think Hitler and Stalin. But a lot of people did not realize it. Today, of course, we see it very strongly, and it's highly important to recognize both sides. Barry Weiss, in her book, adds a third group, which is much more important in Europe than in the U.S., but is found, which is radical Islam, as the three groups most responsible for anti-Semitism today.
Can you address the progressive anti-Semitism? Because I have some friends who are ultra-progressive who bristle at the thought that any anti-Semitism comes from the progressive side of the aisle. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, I understand the ultra-right. I think most people do. But what some people do not understand and refuse to believe and bristle at is to say that it comes from the progressive side as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard not to notice it. What makes it particularly unfortunate, let's say, Congresswoman Omar, with her comments, is that she may have been influenced by anti-Semitic ideas from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, how Jews manipulate the world and control it and so on. She's influenced without even realizing it. And that, in a way, is the most dangerous thing of all, that today, because of the internet, some of those ideas about a Jewish conspiracy, that Jews are the puppeteers, a tiny number of Jews, I remind you, are the puppeteers, that idea is found in all sorts of places on the left. And really the same thing happened when the New York Times in Europe ran a cartoon, which was straight out of the pages of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, with Jews holding the strings, and I think it was Mr. Netanyahu holding the strings of Donald Trump and so on. And the cartoonist claimed he didn't know that was anti-Semitic. He was just commenting on events of the day. And that's really what's going on, I think, on the progressive left. Tragically, ideas about Jews, ideas about Israel have become so prevalent in some of those circles that they don't even realize that it's anti-Semitic. And truly, it behooves us today to realize that there are ideas on the extreme left and on the extreme right, and we really have to be cognizant of anti-Semitism wherever it exists.
Well, thank you for that explanation. I want to switch topics and talk about the American-Jewish relationship with Israel. It's been, as I've read some of your writings, a constantly evolving, changing relationship. As obviously the nature of the state of Israel has been evolving, developing, changing, as you know, before it existed, and then as a baby nation. But obviously, there's this clear pressure that comes from the American Jewish community that you hear about in Israel. And the concern of this disconnect of American Jews or Jews in the diaspora from Israel. I mean, do you see this as something that's cyclical as well, or how would you describe it today, and where do you think we're going?
I think there is a concern, and I think you especially see a generational issue between those who remember the Six-Day War and the events leading up to it, and who remember a very weak Israel, or even some who remember before the State of Israel, when you had all of those refugees, displaced persons with nowhere to go. That's one group. And then you see a younger generation that has only known a strong Israel and has grown up with media reports of a strong Israel, persecuting Palestinians. So that generation gap is real. The interesting thing is that as far back as we can go, young Jews have been more reticent about Israel. Older Jews have been much more committed. So if you remember, Mark Twain said about his father was a remarkable man. The older I get, the smarter he gets. And so it is about Israel, I think. The older Jews get, the smarter Israel gets. And that certainly is the case. Nevertheless, there's, with good reason, lots of concern about young Jews who are disaffected. And back to progressivism, a lot of progressives insist you've got to make a choice. Either you're progressive liberal, in which case you have to be anti-Israel, they say, or you can be pro-Israel, in which case you cannot be a progressive liberal. And they quote intersectionalism and so on. And that puts a lot of pressure on liberal Jews who wonder, how can we be both?
Right. It is. It's a dilemma that a lot of Jews right now are struggling with.
I think that dilemma is there. I think when one probes, one finds that a lot of those who truly question the existence of the State of Israel really don't know very much about it and have really been fed a lot of what we might call fake news. I hear among people who are otherwise well-informed that, isn't it true that Theodore Herzl argued for genocide against people of Palestine. Well, no, it's not true. Oh. And you can't find it, but that is certainly one of the claims.
Wow.
One of the claims made. I think that we need better to distinguish between those who may not like the current government in Israel, just as actually there are Americans who are not fond of the current government in the United States.
I'm in the camp on both of those.
So that's a very, very different matter.
Right.
You can be opposed to the American government without saying, well, America itself was born in sin and shouldn't exist. Indeed, it would be absurd to make such a claim. But a lot of the people who don't like the Israeli government really do support policies that aim to destroy the state of Israel itself. And anyone who really looks at the ideology, say, of the BDS movement, discovers that it seeks to destroy the state of Israel itself.
Right.
And that's, I think, the real difference. And liberal Jews need to be able to articulate their disagreement with the current government, but their support for the state of Israel, which, after all, has saved millions of lives. It's hard to point to anything that Jews have done since World War II that has saved as many lives as the state of Israel. And I don't think we recognize and state that as often as we should. I had hoped that more American Jews would look at the refugees in the Middle East, look at Syria, look now at the Kurds, and say, wow, aren't we fortunate to have a Jewish state where if you need to go there, they need to take you in.
That's right.
And they do take you in. But that's not something that a lot of Jews are still taught or well understand.
Getting back to your being able to be a progressive and be in favor or against Israel, do you find it ironic that if Bernie Sanders was elected, he would be the first Jewish president, but might be one of the least friendly people toward Israel? Do you find an irony, or is that what you were talking about?
Remember, I teach at Brandeis University. Of course, Louis Brandeis was in many ways the model progressive and was the leader of American Zionism. And what an irony that a movement that attracted so many progressives and that really imagined that progressive ideals would be fulfilled in the state of Israel. Nowadays, the heirs of Louis Brandeis believe that they have to turn on Israel and even sometimes hide their Jewish background in order to be progressive. I think it's deeply unfair. Fortunate that progressive Jews have not been able to articulate their vision of a progressive Zionism and what that would be and what it would mean. I think that today, too many people like Bernie Sanders and like others in the Democratic Party believe that if you want to attract the left, you have to criticize Israel and you cannot be a strong supporter of Israel and also make claim to the left wing of the Democratic Party. That never was the case until recently. For much of the last 70 years, both parties outdid themselves to show their support for Israel, and that is a disturbing change.
Can I go way back in history? Because I read this
way back
yeah. to the let's go to the Civil War, and you write about Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant, and I find this fascinating. Can you tell the story that you have written about Lincoln having to censure Grant in terms of Jewish people that were under his command, and then Grant made a 180 when he became president.
And few people really know that in the midst of the Civil War, Grant is moving south in December of 1862. He issues what is really the most infamous official order in terms of Jews in all of American history, where he expels what he calls Jews as a class from his entire war zone, which is a large area. He believed that they were smugglers and that the way to end smuggling was to expel Jews. Of course, we now know there were plenty of smugglers among his own soldiers. Anyway, he expels those Jews. Fortunately, for the Jewish community, one of those Jews whom he expels very rapidly makes his way to Washington and gets in to see Abraham Lincoln. And because telegraph lines had been cut, Lincoln knew nothing about this order. Mm-hmm. And the minute he sees it, he reverses the order. And so, the Jews are not expelled, reverses the order. And then, of course, we know what happened. Grant becomes the great hero. This story is somewhat forgotten until his enemies resurrect it when he runs for president in 1868. But the amazing thing, and the thing that so impressed me working on the matter, was he didn't lie about it. He didn't say it's fake news. He didn't say, the media misinterpreted it. He basically apologized for the order, explaining that it took place in the middle of war and it should never have been issued. And he then, as president, probably appointed more Jews than all previous presidents put together.
Wow.
And really went out of his way to prove that he had changed, that he had repented, that he didn't want to be remembered as the kind of person who expelled Jews from his war zone. And that's a different model of America, and one that deserves to be remembered.
Wow. Well, I really appreciate you coming on. You sound like the type of professor who I would love to take your class, because you weave the story so well and in such an interesting manner. I hope sometime you can come back and join us again. It was enlightening. It was just a terrific conversation, and we appreciate you being with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much, and happy holiday to you.
Happy holiday to
you
as well. Thank you. Bye-bye. What we're going to do is take a little break, then we're going to come back and take phone calls. We have some people waiting online. Our studio line is 813-239-9663. We will get to those calls in just a moment. We want to thank everybody who supported WMNF during our fall fund drive. We're thankful for the thousands of donations that so many of you gave, but we just didn't reach our goal. So if you haven't given yet, please do so. You can do so in many ways. You can go to WMNF.org on the app, or you can try 813-238-8001 weekdays. And again, we are grateful, because that's what keeps this radio station going. Welcome back. This is The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I am Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe.
And we've got a bunch of calls on the line here. So
I think number two has been holding the longest.
Okay, number two has been holding. Let me see. I made this thing.
So it says Eric and St. Pete.
Okay, hang on. Let me get to that. Line number two, righty here. Eric and St. Pete, you're on the air. Eric, you with us?
Yes.
There we go.
This is Eric. I'm calling in just to kind of respond to the last professor who I thought was interesting. I am a millennial Jewish kid, kind of who we're referring to, who I would say more or less identifies as progressive. I mean, I don't really like the categories like that, but I like a lot of progressive ideals. But I don't think that it's necessarily true that it's a large worry that a lot of my generation is not in support of Israel or doesn't have a connection to it. In my personal experience, I think the thing that was most important to me was the Birthright Foundation Birthright trip.
Did you take advantage of it?
Yes, I did.
Terrific.
And I think that they have actually extended the age to 32, so I think it's available to a lot more people.
Yes.
And I kind of went in older. I was about 26 or 27, which was good because it was kind of less of a party, and I kind of went in with more of a objective look. And, you know, it's just like everything else. You really have to be there. You really have to meet people and see that it's much more cohesive there than what's stated on the news. And I certainly have my disagreements with the government of Israel, you know, in the same way I have my disagreements with the government here. And there are a lot of things that I disagree with. And I wouldn't say that I'm not also supportive of Palestinians in a lot of ways. But I don't think it's impossible to be a young millennial progressive Democrat Jewish kid and also, you know, have support for Israel and be able to kind of speak to it.
I'm glad you shared that.
Eric, thank you for calling and sharing that experience. There are some progressives that get a bad rap on that, and clearly you've sort of sorted through everything as well, and we appreciate you calling. We got a lot of calls waiting, so we're going to have to move on, and we're going to go to Simon in Lakeland, who's one of our regular callers. Simon, how are you?
How are you, Simon?
Hi, good morning. Happy holidays.
Thank you.
I would have hoped that the guest was still on. I would have asked him a few questions of the influence of Black Zionism that did filter into the Black culture. The other question I have is that I wanted to ask him, and I don't know if either one of you have ever read the scholarly book by Laurel Leaf, Buried by the Times, in which she wrote a book that over 24,000 front page articles on the New York Times from 1939 to 1945. Of the 24,000 articles, only six listed Jews as victims during World War II, and that was by the New York Times. The other aspect that I wanted to bring up very shortly is why Jews, we don't speak monolithically. Even in the Talmud, only 20% of the Jews left Egypt during the Exodus. A lot of people don't understand that. But Jews vote Democrat here, and if you look at the iconoclastic Democratic president, FDR, very anti-Semitic. The M Project, the fact that he wanted to thin out Jews across the world by not allowing them to come to the United States. And we will continue as Jews not to really view ourselves as being anything proud of who we are in this country. Quick example, Ilhan Omar, she wears a traditional hijab. Jack Lew, who was Secretary of Treasury, an Orthodox Jew who didn't work on Saturday, you never saw him with the yarmulke. Ben Bernanke, Orthodox Jew, Federal Reserve, you never saw him with a yarmulke. Why is it as Jews that we have to feel a assimilated in this country and be afraid of who we are.
Well, that's what we are talking about. Right. So, Simon, I think that, you know, that was one of the things we're talking about with Professor Sarna. There's, and it, this goes back, you know, again, with Theodore Herzl and so many others, this constant desire, no matter where we are, is this, the Jews, unless you're in your own homeland, have done everything they can to avoid anti-Semitism and hate. And so they think the best way to do it is let's just assimilate. Let's just assimilate and be like everyone else and be the best American or the best French person or the best German or the best what, you know, and assimilate. So I think that's it's this constant struggle, you know, that Jews have with their own, you know, self-hate. And so we need to sort of assimilate to avoid anti-Semitism. But we know that's not the solution. And
but
we
I can't
that doesn't work.
I can't fault Omar for the way she dresses.
But your point is that she's wearing it proudly.
Right.
She's doing it proudly. I think
wearing it proudly. And, I admire her for respecting who she is.
Absolutely.
Right. Barry Weiss did a great piece, I think, last month in the New York Times about really the only answer, because it's this constant struggle she was talking about. It's the same thing. It's this constant battle of, like, we want to assimilate. But she said, you know, the best way to really stop anti-Semitism is just to be the best Jew that you can be and be out there. Be a proud Jew.
Say it loud and be proud.
Yeah, exactly. So there you go.
Simon,
we all merit Mashiach now.
Oh, yeah. We've got a lot of calls. Thank you for calling. That was a good addition to it. We have Rob and Thanota Sassa. And Rob, thanks for holding for so long. You're on the air.
Oh, great show. I'm really enjoying it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to bring up just very quickly, you know, one of the problems, I have many friends who are progressive liberals. I'm just more or less in the middle, and I have friends who are conservative. But when you really start to back them into a corner, most really progressive Democrats pretty much don't think Israel should have been formed. You know what I mean? Which, to me, is the difference between sort of criticizing the Israeli government and being anti-Semitic.
Absolutely.
Of course,
absolutely. Right.
So it's the right to exist. Exactly.
That needs to be pointed out. If you don't think Israel has a right to exist, that's anti-Semitic. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Now, you don't like Netanyahu? That's fine. It's fair game. You know what I mean? But not to, and it also doesn't, one quick thing, I know you have a lot of calls. It doesn't help that you have people like Noam Chomsky, who is absolutely the intellectual guiding light of the far left, who himself is Jewish, you know, going over and embracing Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, and adopting a very, I wouldn't say he believes Israel shouldn't exist, but he's very, very critical of Israel, and I think people take a cues from him, and he is the... he is the leading left intellectual, and he's very, very harsh on Israel.
Well, it's like I said with Professor Sarna, it's ironic to me that if Bernie Sanders were to be elected, he'd be the first Jewish president, but possibly as unfriendly to Israel as any president we've seen in recent years.
You know, what's interesting about it is that Israel, you know, by far in the Middle East and certainly in the world, is one of the most progressive countries in the world. When you look at the treatment of minorities, the treatment of women, the treatments of gays, and just the different rights that exist and the constant efforts. You're talking really about a nascent country that's only been around for, you know, 71 years now. So
I believe they have one of the largest gay pride film festivals in the world.
One of the largest gay pride parades in the world, certainly the largest in the Middle East.
Right. Very, 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 it's like having a Scandinavian country in the Middle East.
Right.
And I think that's where you know, that balance, and people don't understand. I mean, even some of the laws on work and wages, et cetera. I mean, they just, and unionizing, they just have some very progressive values. Because when you go back and you look at the ideals of the founding fathers and the founding mothers, I mean, they came there with those progressive ideals.
Absolutely.
And so much is already woven into really the firmament of what the country is. So but it's true. I mean, and I'm glad that Professor Sarna was able to sort of talk about the irony with Bernie Sanders and that frustration of, you know, forgetting really those progressive roots of someone like Louis Brandeis, for instance. So,
thank you for your call. If you guys would like to weigh in, our studio line is 813-239-9663. You can give us a call, and we have Dan from Newport Richey who is on the air. Dan, go ahead.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak, Michael. I've always had the greatest respect for Jews who have always put justice forward, whether we're talking about Spinoza or Maimonides or Brandeis or Ginsburg. But I'd like you to do something for me. If you would, hold in your one hand the fact that you know I'm very opposed to the Israeli government and that I do support the BDS. And in the other hand, I'd like you to hold this. My first job, like Elijah Cummings, was working for a Jewish pharmacist, and he treated me like a son. I worked in Jewish resorts like the Nevely Country Club, and the owners, the Selutsky family, knew me by name, and they treated me, again, like one of their own. And that's my background. When I was in high school and saw two white kids beating up an Orthodox Jewish kid, I intervened. When I was at a party not so long ago with only African-American friends, I heard them deriding the Jews, and I spoke up and defended Jews based upon my experiences and what I know of them. I helped to organize the vigils that were held for the Jews killed at Poway and Tree of Life here in Pasco County. And in both instances, we filled the building with our diverse community. So that's in your one hand. In the other hand, as the professor said, he believes that BDS is seeking to destroy Israel. So am I anti-Semitic?
Yeah, but
I'm not sure where the point is. But, I mean, Dan, you also, you support Nakba Day, right?
Say that again, please.
You support Nakba Day?
I do.
Okay.
Explain what that is.
Right. So, you know, for the audience, I mean, Nakba Day is the reference by the Palestinians of the, in essence, the day of their destruction. It's a day of great remorse and sadness. It's a day that five large Arab armies surrounded and attacked and bombed and started the war against Israel in May of 1948. So, you know, many died in that war. Israel didn't ask for that war. Israel was invaded and surrounded by five very large, well-financed, well-trained militaries. So when you tell me that you support something like that, and I appreciate everything that you said, Dan, but, you know, to me, it's a contradiction. You know, you're in essence saying, you know, again, agreeing with the fact that Israel doesn't have a right to exist and blaming Israel somehow for the five Arab nations that, you know, surrounded and attacked her that day with the intent of destroying her. You know, to me, that it doesn't make sense. And knowing that the BDS movement doesn't agree with the existence of Israel, knowing that members of Hamas, you know, you were saying last week, you were, Arafat's dead. Arafat may be dead, but his ideas are still very much alive as they existed before him, and they continue to exist as members of Hamas and other Islamic fronts in the Palestinian Authority and in Gaza, don't believe that they can give an inch of land to Israel, and they don't want peace, and they want to continue fighting. And to them, the only solution is war. And that's a problem because, you know, I am for Palestinian human rights, and I'm for them having a homeland, but I'm against war, and I'm against the idea that people always want to excuse the Palestinian people, who really need to have, at some point, they need to hold their own government and their own leaders responsible, because there are many Palestinian people who don't agree with war, who don't want that, but at some point, they're the only people group who can hold these people responsible and say, this is not what we want, and to rid their society of these warmongers. They're the only ones who could do it. Israel can't do it. We can't do it here in the U.S., but an organization like BDS and other things like that, they pretty much give those organizations a green card. You know, they just say, go ahead, go. You can just do whatever you want to do. We're not going to hold you accountable. We're not even going to look at you. We're going to pretend like everything you do is fine. And that's the problem with the dialogue, because it's very one-sided, and you're never going to have peace that way.
I wonder, Dan, if you don't acknowledge, or if you do acknowledge, that BDS hurts Palestinians who live in Israel as much, if not even more so, than Israelis. Does that not occur to you?
The same thing happened in South Africa, Michael.
But wait. South Africa and Israel are totally different. Wait. Give me a second, and then I'll let you respond. Okay. South Africa, blacks did not have any power. They were suppressed.
Rights.
They had no rights. They couldn't do anything.
Please,
in Israel, there are Arabs in the Knesset. There are Arabs on the Supreme Court. They are fully vested in the state of Israel. And for the most part, not the leadership and not everybody, but for the most part, they are proud to be Israelis. They are not Israeli Jews. They're Israeli Arabs or Israeli Palestinians, both maybe one and the same. So to make BDS equivalent with South Africa is just a false narrative. It's conflating two things that really are not similar.
And doesn't help the dialogue. It confuses the issue. Then,
But let me point out, BDS is about the Palestinians. It's not about the Israeli Arabs.
But there are Palestinians that live in Israel, and the Palestinians that come to Israel to work, right?
Right. So the BDS movement was founded at the famous conference that was held in Durban, South Africa, where you had NGOs from all over the world come, and with the intent of, in essence, delegitimizing Israel. And they specifically went there to call Israel an apartheid state. You know where there is an apartheid, by the way? There's these huge signs before you go into the West Bank that say, Israelis, Jews aren't allowed. You can't go in. I mean, I can't imagine, Palestinians saying, the Palestinian Authority saying, you know what, we welcome Jews to live with us, we want them to come live in our community, when in fact there are signs saying that you're not even permitted to enter. Whereas Israel, on the other hand, is a very diverse population, a very diverse community, but like any country and any community, there are pockets of people that are extreme. And, Israel does a great job of trying to rid that cancer from society. But, you can't call it an apartheid state because it doesn't help in the dialogue, Dan. It doesn't actually help the Palestinian people and bring peace and resolution. What it does is it creates confusion. It creates a false narrative. And then nobody's holding the Palestinian Authority and Hamas and these leaders responsible for the suffering of their people.
Dan, we have to move on because we've got a lot of callers. We're going to run out of time.
But Mike,
yeah,
I thank you both for basically having a decent argument. But I would also add that Nakba is not about being said that Israel was not destroyed. It's about the suffering of the Palestinians who were forced to leave their homes.
Okay. All right. We're going to have to pick it up some other time. Thanks for calling, Dan. Mark in St. Pete, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Can you hear me loud and clear?
Yep, loud and clear.
Okay. Your last guest, I think, was right on the money, and the pun's unintended, because I think that goes into my opinion, that I don't think anti-Semitism is about the specific of the Jewish religion, because if it were, then you wouldn't have devout Protestants and devout Catholics being generally, pro-Jewish and pro-Israeli. I was raised a Catholic, and we were next door to a synagogue, and we had all.
Hello.
Oh wait, what happened?
What happened? We lost you, Mark. I don't know. The phone just went away. I don't think he hung up, and I didn't hang up on you, Mark.
We didn't touch anything.
Didn't touch it.
Sometimes we do.
If you call back real quickly, we got just about a minute and a half.
Well, yeah. Well, you know what? Actually, while we're waiting for him, there was this really great piece in the Times of Israel earlier this week on... it's called How Hasidic Rabbis Helped an Orthodox Father of Six Become True to Herself. And really about this young man who was, a very devout Hasidic man. And he wanted to go through the transition to become a woman. And just a lovely, lovely story on the help that he had. And just so I would encourage, if you're interested, to pick up that and read it. I thought that was a great piece this week. Couple other things obviously going on around the world. I was really disturbed by this anti-Semitic event in Ukraine.
Yeah.
but I guess October 14th is a day of commemoration of different things, but it's also a day that where historically pogroms have been carried out against Jews, and there is a bloody effigy of a Ukrainian Jewish oligarch left outside a synagogue. earlier this
week. I don't mean to interrupt you. We've got Mark back on for a half a second, but we don't have much time. Mark, you've got about 15 seconds to. I'll let you wrap up your thought, and okay. I apologize. Call back next week, and we'll get you on. Go ahead.
I don't think it's anti-Semitism. It's jealousy, and that's why you've got the left. They're worried about income distribution and so on. I think it's jealousy, and I think it all boils down
okay.
to that.
Mark, call back next week. We'll get you back on. We're running
Thank
out of time.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, everyone.
This is the Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Javid.
Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Listening to WMNF Tampa this Sunday, October 20th, 2019. I'm Joy Katzen Guthrie. Welcome to the Sunday Simcha.
Leute, Kinder, wir haben Simchas Teure, Simchas Teure auf der ganzen Welt. Teure